Kia ora, and welcome back to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I'm editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. System Fix takes a look at progress with the health sector restructuring proposed by the Simpson Report, the highs and the lows, where we might be going, and occasionally where we've come from. This is a special episode of System Fix. Let's call it a wrangled episode, as I've roped in work carried out by New Zealand Doctor senior journalist Martin Johnson. Before Christmas, Martin had been chasing an interview with Health Minister Andrew Little to discuss progress on the health changes. He had little success. But 2021 has dawned. We returned to the office on Monday, and Tuesday afternoon, Martin had his interview. Martin started by asking the Minister how his summer had been.
Good, you know, saw a lot of the summer, so it was a good thing, yeah.
Good. So I want to ask mainly about the Health and Disability System Review, but a couple of general questions as well. The first thing I wanted to ask you was who you've met with, particularly from the primary healthcare sector, to discuss the reform program.
I hadn't met with a great deal of people out of the primary healthcare sector. Really, just towards the end of the last year, I've met with a couple of the DHBs and their governance and senior managers and some of the union reps. And the next sort of couple of months, I'll get around. Look, there's a vast array of stakeholder groups, but I'll get around a lot more of them. I know that one of the critical objectives of the whole HDSR report is actually improving what we do in the primary healthcare and community care sector. And that I have a personal commitment to see that through. So that'll be a priority part of my work over the next couple of 3 months.
Okay. You mentioned DHB. So what sort of deputations have you received from DHBs about the health reforms?
I mean, I've done a couple of visits to Canterbury and Southern DHB. It was really just to gauge kind of where, particularly those two DHBs that have had their challenges more recently, where things are at. I engaged with some of the clinical leaders in with those DHBs as well. We didn't get heavily into the reform process. We focused very much on some of the institutional issues. That discussion necessarily led to the nationwide network of hospitals and healthcare, but we didn't get heavily into the HDSR report or the reform process.
Right. So have you had thoughts yet about which DHBs will go and which will stay?
No, we're sort of working through a bit of process and sort of policy development, sort of getting back to the underlying principles that the HDSR report represented or reflected, and the objectives that it stands for, which is, you know, improving, at least moving away from the more fragmentary style sort of system we have at the moment to something more cohesive, and a secondary objective, which is to beef up our primary healthcare and community care sort of sector, which is where the more we can do there and alleviate the pressure off secondary and tertiary, there are more health gains to be had there than just plowing ever more money into hospitals, which is, I think, the balance we've been trying to achieve for many, many years.
Can you give us a bit of insight into what some of the plans might be for changes at Tier 1?
I can't go into anything specific at the moment. As I say, we're still very much working through the analysis and response to the HDSR report and putting the policy together on what future changes might look like. Notwithstanding that Cabinet has signed off on agreed with the general direction of that report, we know that we want to see, in terms of system governance, a better kind of structure and a setup to allow focus on performance of organisations, DHBs and hospitals, but also achieving better performance in terms of the way we set up and engage and develop primary healthcare. So there won't be any kind of crystallised decisions until later in the year. It'll be, end of first quarter sort of thing. But you should expect some announcements around, the beginning of the second quarter.
You talked to the Herald and other media about accelerating the timeframe, and we saw some material about that too. I wanted to ask, why is it planned to start implementing the Tier 1 changes first in July, even before the passing of the overall enabling legislation, which I think is expected to happen sometime next year, on the first half of next year or so?
Yeah, I think, look, subject to the ultimate decisions, there are a set of things that can happen without the need for legislation, even at the kind of senior structural level. The legislation will reflect kind of mandated responsibilities and obligations, but there's stuff that can happen without a lot of legislative change. So to the extent, I think the point you're making is you kind of work out what you want to achieve, you build the structure to go with it, and then you populate that. That's an orthodox approach, and I don't tend to depart too heavily from that. But I think what the HDSR report kind of highlights is that there are some problems in the system as a whole now that are acute, and that just sort of leaving it for longer and longer just means more and more people missing out and actually, compounding the long-term cost to the system as a whole. So I'm having kind of read the report, and with the advice, the benefit of the advice that I've had, I'm of a mind that we really need to kind of start to make change now and get that underway if we want to start to see the benefits sooner rather than later.
Some of the tier one changes, though, rely presumably on significant changes at DHBs and nationally. So that sort of seems a wee bit surprising that tier one has picked for changes to get underway and sort of be finished before changes happen elsewhere in the system.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to there. I mean, the change, the reality is you change one part of the system, you're going to affect other parts too. So part of the work over the next couple of 3 months is to put together that plan so we know, what is happening, what the sequences of what is happening, what the implications are of change when it happens in particular parts of the system. But there's no hard and fast kind of delineation of, right, we'll do tier one, then we'll move on to these other things. And then, we'll, at some point we'll legislate for the overarching structure. Actually, once change starts, it'll happen across the board. And the reality is what I would like to see happen is we get the kind of physical change and the structural change done as quickly as we can, so that the real hard yards of getting systems and procedures and practices and culture, getting that change in place and moving, we get into that, more quickly, because that's the stuff that takes a long time to develop and to bed in.
Yeah, I was referring to the Stephen McKernan timeline that he discussed with several organisations in the latter part of last year.
So no decisions have been made on implementation plans or timelines, so that is yet to come.
The government seems to have been virtually avoiding public engagement over the reforms. Why is this?
No, we haven't. There's been, I would describe as kind of reasonably low level. There'll be a more formalised, systematic approach unfolding from next month, because, in order for successful implementation and to get the good decisions when we get to the decision-making phase, we need to have that consultative input. So that will get underway, as I say, in February.
What are some of the elements of that?
Look, it's getting around the range of stakeholders. I think there's still a bit of work to formulate what that looks like that is going to be most effective. But the obligation, if only a moral obligation, but actually if we want good practical outcomes, is we have to engage. We have to engage properly. The promise I've made in the speeches I've given so far as Health Minister, Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, to some of the DHBs, is I've made a commitment that we will be engaging properly in good faith and in a meaningful sort of way. That will get underway, as I say, in February.
Under Labor's treaty commitment, you'll probably be taking iwi and hapu advice on the shape of the Māori Health Authority. Who are you being held to gather iwi and hapu views? And who's overseeing this and reporting back? And can you tell us anything that you're hearing from that process?
Yeah, I've had a meeting with the Hauora Coalition, the folks who are kind of behind the Y2585 claim. 2575 claim.
Yep.
So we've had a meeting with them. Pini Hinari, who's Associate Health and with responsibility for Māori Health, he's been engaging probably less formally with a number of iwi providers. Again, we will formalise that engagement over the months to come. We've made the commitment. We've agreed that we are going to have a Māori Health Authority, and we want to engage over with Māori about what that looks like, and we need to settle on what the scope of responsibility of the Māori Health Authority. Is there a commissioning role? Does that include co-commissioning? Where does that sit in relation to, the Ministry, Health NZ, and any other entity, that flows out of the change?
You've been reading my questions, I think.
No leaks from New Zealand Doctor.
So I take it from that you haven't formed a view yet on the extent of commissioning power the Māori Health Authority might have.
No, I know the report said talked more about kind of monitoring, advisory and what have you role. The language I've used since I've been minister is that actually we have a real challenge when it comes to equity of health outcomes and equity of health provision. And I'm determined that what we do has got to be a game changer when it comes to provision of vital health services. So I make no secret, I am looking beyond where the HDSR report got to in terms of the role of the Māori Health Authority. But we'll continue to engage and consult on that. And ultimately, when Cabinet makes its decisions towards the end of March, we'll kind of know where that settles at.
How much reliance are you placing on the whānau ora model in working out those issues?
Yeah, I know that's. I think that provides a very good model, you know, and that is a model of future healthcare, actually, for a lot, you know, not just for Māori, but actually for communities right around the country. So looking very closely at that.
Okay, so we might see some quite radical change that is in line with Labor's commitment to the Treaty of Waitangi.
Not for me to get ahead of my Cabinet colleagues, but I think we all agree that health is an area where, you know, change is needed. To address the really serious challenge we've got of inequitable health outcomes for different population groups.
Okay. Have you appointed the Section 11 committee yet?
No, that shouldn't be too far away.
So have you got all of the members in mind?
No, they're still thinking about composition. There are a lot of names floating around, but I won't be too far off pulling that together.
All right. Who are the members of the Stephen McKernan team?
That's the transition unit, which sits in DPMC. I don't have the names off the top of my head of who is in that group, but there's that's the group that DPMC have put together, because we can't have the Ministry of Health obviously doing reforms of the very system that it's responsible for leading.
So turning away from the system review to another Labor commitment, the public health agency, this national public health agency that you want to establish, as much work going on with that yet? And how do you see that agency functioning, and what risks are posed by separating this function from the Ministry of Health?
Yeah, I know those are all good questions that we're in the process of doing. This is a political commitment that came out of Labor. It was in our manifesto to have a discrete, identifiable public health agency. So whether that becomes like a departmental agency within the ministry, whether it is, you know, like a crown entity that's completely separate or independent, I mean, those questions that are being dealt with at the moment. I think the whole idea, however, is to ensure we get on that public health kind of front greater cohesion across the country. We've been very well served by the 12 public health units of the DHBs, particularly, and they've come to their own in terms of the COVID response. But actually, I think it has also become apparent that there were elements of that setup that made it challenging in the early days to get a consistent response. When you look outside sort of just pandemics and you look at other health issues, you know, alcohol, tobacco, those sorts of things that are the bread and butter of public health practitioners, actually trying to get some consistency across the system as a whole, there is a need for that, and an agency will help us with that.
Then a general question with you and your associate ministers. How do you manage your relationships with the three associates and the COVID-19 minister, Chris Hopkins? Do you meet with all of them together once a week, or meet with them all separately once a week? And are there things that you have to do on behalf of Chris Hopkins because the legislation actually states that it has to be done by the Minister of Health?
On the first point, no, that in terms of my associates and myself, we will meet together. We meet once a week together with the officials. We all get the same report, and we all meet with officials at the same time, because it's important to me that I know that all my associates, everybody is on the same page and knows all the issues that are going on. In terms of COVID-19, because of Chris's other responsibilities, I tend to meet with him more periodically, just on a one-on-one basis. There's a lot of sharing of information and a bit of coordination required. His area is quite discreet, so that kind of looks after itself, and we kind of share information about that. And sorry, there's a latter part of your question.
Are there things that legislation stipulates that you have to do? So Chris Hopkins has to come to you and say, sign this.
In terms of the stuff that's specific to COVID-19, we changed the legislation to the relevant designated minister. So the Prime Minister determines who's got the ministerial authority. And that was to deal with the very point, particularly when it comes to issuing orders under the COVID response legislation, is that we've got a COVID-19 response minister the legislation previously referred to just the health minister. So we've changed it so that Chris takes responsibility for all of that. So that's now that all works quite well. I am kept in touch with and I am consulted on those sorts of things as health minister, but Chris has the statutory authority to do the things that, that the legislation requires.
Finally, with primary healthcare funding, there's been at least one attempt to get the funding changed to incorporate more refinement so that there's weightings for old age, ethnicity and deprivation in addition to gender and age. Have you been briefed on that proposal and do you have a view on it?
I haven't had any specific advice on the funding formula, but it has come up incidentally in advice and briefings that I've had. I am aware that it is an issue, and certainly in my discussions with health practitioners and particularly with the DHBs, the issue about the suitability or the currency of the current population-based funding formula has come up. It is an issue we are going to have to address, in my view, at some point. But that'll be, I think, a second-order issue once we get through the structural issues that the reform process requires.
Yeah. So what's exercising your mind on health today?
Today, what have I done on health today? I mean, there's a number of routine operational issues just to be kept abreast of. And there's, in terms of the vaccination issue, there's receiving some advice about the possibility of early acquisition of vaccines. That been dealing with in conjunction with Chris Hipkins and other ministers. So those are the things that sort of come up.
So you're trying to work on advanced delivery of first vaccine doses?
Well, we've got our direct relationship with the pharmaceutical companies who have been developing vaccines, and we've also subscribed to the COVAX facility, which is the international facility. So through the COVAX facility, because of the new strain of COVID-19 that has come about, the much more contagious one, there have been suggestions about getting earlier access for countries like ours that are in a comparatively safer situation, getting earlier access to vaccines. And so we're just working our way through that process.
Okay. Good. Well, thanks for your time, Andrew. Good to talk.
Thanks, mate. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for being so easily available this time.
Not a problem. Cheers. Yeah.
You've been listening to Martin Johnson, Senior Journalist at New Zealand Dr. Rata Aotearoa, interviewing the Health Minister, Andrew Little, on 19th of January 2021. This was a System Fix podcast. System Fix is brought to you by the Health Media, proud publishers of New Zealand Dr. Rata Aotearoa, Pharmacy Today, Kaitiaki Rongo o Te Wā, and the Rosta Te Rārangi. Also, e-learning, providing education for primary care professionals. You can find out more about our publications at thehealthmedia.co.nz or subscribe to New Zealand Doctor at www.nzdoctor.co.nz. Thanks for listening. This is Barbara signing off. Until the next time.